Committee on Rules for May 29th, 2009. The intent of the chair is to do one or two fairly straightforward bills, which if you, there's a lot of people here to testify in a bill that's not a straightforward bill. And then as soon as I get at least one more member, hopefully two, to go to the work sessions that we have posted, the items that are work sessions only. So I'm going to open a public hearing on HB 3033. And if Mr. Chandler would come forward and if the committee administrator would give a brief overview.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3033A limits signature gathering period to 2 years for initiative petition for county or city measures, requires an initiative petition for city or county measure be submitted at least 90 days before the election that the measure is to be voted on. There is a no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. It comes to you with an 8-0 vote from the House rules and off the floor 60-0.
Okay, Mr. Chandler, why don't you start?
May we chair, may I briefly, Chair Devlin, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here in support of House Bill 3033.
And Mr. Chair, members, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of House Bill 3033. The reason this bill is in front of you is it addresses a situation at the local level where initiative petitions currently have no time limit. They can be circulated for years, often are. What this bill does is simply correct that what we think it was an oversight in the drafting originally to make the time limit 2 years at the local level, very identical to the state initiative process. As you were already informed, it came out of committees 8-0, floor 60-0. And in summary, I simply like to say, good bill.
Should pass.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I would be more impressed if the chicken suits had been employed on this bill as well. This choreography is not quite complete without the costumes.
Think of this, Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrer, think of this as more of a kabuki, very elegant in its simplicity.
Get the hook, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I have a gentleman here that it's hard for me to read the name. Greg Wassum. Yes, Mr. Wassum, please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Wassum, and I've spent much of the last 20 years reading about, thinking about, and writing about the history of the initiative in Oregon. And I'm here. The two-year limit is, in Salem it's 100 days, so there's no problem with the merits of the bill, but you simply do not have the power to impose limitations on the initiative that are not in the Constitution. It's no different than by statute this committee imposing restrictions on the courts that aren't in the Constitution. If you want to put a limit on the time that initiatives can be circulated, then a constitutional amendment is the way to do it, not a simple statute. The two-year limitation on the state level stems from an attorney general's opinion in the early 60s, which by statutory interpretation imposes a two-year limit on the statewide initiative, which is not in the Constitution. I currently have a suit before the Court of Appeals challenging the two-year limitation on the state level. You simply do not have the constitutional authority to place limits on a constitutionally equal institution, which the initiative and referendum is.
Can I ask
you? Yes. Mr. Wassum. Mr. Wassum, I ask a question. Could you tell me the status of that case?
I submitted my last brief last week, and it's been a while since I've had a case in front of the Court of Appeals, so I don't know how much time they're taking, but it used to be about 4 months between when a case came to issue and an oral hearing was held.
Thank you.
Okay. Any additional questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Have we consulted with Legislative Council on that concept?
I believe we have Legislative Council here. Gina, do you want to come forward?
However reluctantly, Mr. Chair.
If you want to comment on the argument put forward by Mr. Wason. Awesome.
My name is Gina Zeldak, here from the Office of Legislative Counsel. Mr. Watson's correct that it doesn't provide for that two-year limitation in the Constitution. However, as he said, the authority for the interpretation of that does stem from an AG's opinion from, I think, 1963. Not sure on the year. And so based on that interpretation, you could amend the Constitution, but based on that interpretation, we didn't feel that a constitutional amendment was required.
Any questions, additional comments from the committee? Any response from Mr. Wasson?
Only the people do not have a lawyer. The Attorney General theoretically works for the people, but the government signs the Attorney General's checks. So who do you think the Attorney General works for? And the fact that a opinion of the Attorney General that was not challenged because the people don't have a lawyer to challenge it. I mean, I've made my point. So.
Okay. Thank you both very much.
Follow-up, Mr.
Or yes.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wasson, did you testify to the bill on the House side?
No, I didn't. But, of course, a bill which limits the initiative power, it would be silly to testify to try to stop it, I guess. I missed the public hearing on 2005, which is what I wanted to testify on. But then I looked at the agenda, and this jumped out at me. With all due respect, this is arrogance at the highest degree.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. Anything additional?
Chairman, I have one more question, if I may. Your lawsuit deals with this issue.
Well, it does, because the two-year limitation was constructed by the Attorney General based on an earlier Attorney General opinion confining initiatives to the November ballot every other year. And in my lawsuit is a challenge to that administrative rule. So if that opinion is wiped out, then anything based on it would be wiped out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you. Gina, can you stand by? Okay, I'll close the public hearing, open a work session on 3033A. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move House Bill 3033A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, it's been move House Bill 3033A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Ferriol.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Wasson is shooting a little behind the deck here. Since he missed this on the House side, that might have been a really interesting piece of information to have debated in the House before it received a unanimous vote on the House side. The fact that there's a case pending that would decide the fate of the efficacy of the legislature's attempt to regulate or administer the initiative process will inform this bill as well. I see no harm in moving this forward with the caveat that we may end up being told that the action of the legislature has been mooted by the action of the court. So I see no harm in moving this bill forward, but with the caveat that we may end up learning the consequences of arrogance. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any additional comments? Any objections to the motion?
Yes.
Please note Senator Atkinson objects. Motion passes. Close the work session. I'm now going to return to the work sessions that were at the beginning of the agenda, and I will open a work session on House Bill 2005A. Could the committee administrator give a brief overview?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2005A requires a person being paid to obtain signatures on a prospective petition for a state measure to register with the Secretary of State and complete training programs. Prohibits registration by the Secretary of State of a person who, during the five-year period prior to the date of an application, had been convicted of certain criminal offenses involving fraud, forgery, or identification theft, or who has a civil or criminal penalty imposed against them for violations of election law. Requires Department of State Police to provide Secretary of State with information concerning criminal background of applicant for registration. Prohibits person from gathering signatures for prospective petition for which the person is being paid at the same time for the person is for one the person is not being paid for. Prohibits including signatures obtained in violation of this provision. Directs Secretary of State to prepare official templates for cover and signature sheets for prospective petitions for state measures. Requires use of official templates by signature gatherers. Requires chief petitioner to file signature sheets with Secretary of State on a monthly basis. Clarifies that volunteers are not subject to rolling turn-in requirements. Defines liability for instances where chief petitioners and contractors knew or should have known of election law violation. Increases penalties to $10,000 for certain election law violations. Contains severability clause. Declares emergency effective upon passage. You will have a no revenue and a no fiscal impact on the measure.
Okay. Do we have a motion on the main motion to move House Bill 2005A as presented to the floor with a due pass recommendation?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move House Bill 2005A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. It's been moved that 2005A go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Is there no... Chair's not doesn't want to entertain any amendments?
I have had no amendments offered, and I have a main motion on the table right now. That does not mean I...
Is that right?
Okay. Can clerk please call the roll? Committee assistant.
Senator Atkinson.
No.
Senator Burry.
Aye.
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Ferriero.
No.
Chair
Devil. Aye. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Having voted on the in the disaffirmative, I would serve notice of the intent to file a minority report.
Thank you, Senator Ferriero. The intent is noted. Close the work session. Open the work session on SB 519. Brief overview.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 519A prohibits adverse employment action against employee for declining to participate in employer-sponsored meeting or communication about religious or political matters, creates employee civil cause of action, requires employer to post notice of employee rights, provides exceptions for religious or political organizations and for legally required or voluntary meetings or communication, clarifies that bill will not prohibit mandatory meetings of the employer's executives or administrative personnel to discuss issues, including those subjects covered by the bill. There is a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on the A and gross measure.
Okay. Do we have a motion?
Question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Does the bill define what a political matter is?
Gina, or whoever I have from Legislative Council or Committee Administrator.
Mr. Chair, we have the Committee Administrator from the Commerce Committee who can answer that question along with Gina Zedlick from Council, who is here.
Okay. Jeremy Sorant, Committee Administrator of Commerce and Workforce Development Committee. And could you repeat the question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, I was asking whether or not the bill defined what a political matter is.
Defines what?
What is a political matter?
Yeah, I believe it does. Political matters is defined in Section 1, Paragraph 5. Political matters includes political party affiliation, campaigns for legislation,
for candidates for political office, and the decision to join, not join, support, or not support any lawful political or constituent group or activity. And then that refers back to a definition of a constituent group includes but is not limited to civic associations, community groups, social clubs, and mutual of benefit alliances, including labor organizations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Do I have a motion on the case?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Farioli, I don't believe it's the motion I was expecting, but
probably
that's
not,
fine.
Mr. Chairman. a similar question relating to religious matters. I see it defined on Section 6, page 1. Can you explain or help me understand what a bona fide religious organization is?
Well, I think a bona fide religious organization is one whose central purpose is fundamentally religious in nature. And I guess the fact that it's bona fide means that it actually has that central purpose.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not comprehending that definition. Bona fide means that it adheres to a central principle.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Diane Rosenbaum, Chair of the Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development. I believe this language actually appears elsewhere in Oregon statute because there are other exclusions already for religious organizations, so it might be more appropriate to refer that question to legislative counsel. It actually did not come up in our hearings on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, we have legislative counsel in the room, I think.
Yes. Gina, would you please come forward?
Gina Zedlick from the Office of Legislative Counsel, and I have to say that I did not draft this bill, so you may be better off getting the drafter in here on this. I am unfamiliar with it.
Okay. For the sake, Senator Farioli, for the sake, since we are in work session, I will ask for the legislative counsel to come to the committee, to at least comment on that issue in terms of religion. So if he would come to the committee. Okay. I know you did not draft it. It's just,
yeah.
I mean, I'm just.
519.
Mr. Chairman, I'm interested in having the legislative council who drafted the bill differentiate a non-bona fide religious organization from a bona fide religious organization.
And since we are in work session, and while you're asking that, waiting for the person to come, I will take the chair's prerogative and I will move SB 519 as presented to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Now, I will still continue the discussion and wait for legislative council. Okay. Senator Farioli, while we're waiting, my understanding is Mr. Cheeks is the legislative counsel that drafted the bill. He is not here today, but they are searching for someone that can answer your question. Do you have any additional questions we could go to now?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any additional questions at the top of my mind. I might have a question after I hear Mr. Cheek's explanation of the difference between a bona fide religious organization and one that would not be.
Okay. Mr. Cheeks is not actually available today.
Okay. So or whomever comes from West
Council. Any additional questions? What I will do at this point is I will follow my rules of procedure here.
Are you asking for just questions or discussions?
Questions and discussion.
And this will be the last chance to speak before you take the
vote. You will have a chance after the question is answered also. It's a work session. For the time being, I will close this work session, and then I will be coming back to this work session as soon as we get legislative counsel here. I will be opening a work session on 767A. Can the committee administrator give a brief overview of the bill and the Dash 23 amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will introduce what's in your packet. We have the committee administrator from the Education and General Government Committee here to address the staff message summary and the amendments. You will find in your packet a Dash A-29 amendment, a fiscal statement on the Dash A-29, testimony from the Oregon Virtual Schools Alliance, testimony from Representative Buckley and the OEA, and then you will also find a packet of written testimony received to the committee. There are 41 emails attached to that testimony, and Dana Richardson is here now.
Would you like a summary of the
amendments,
Mr. Chair?
Please, Ms. Richardson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's the A-23s have provisions that essentially make virtual school employees assure that they are employees underneath a public body, whether or not it's the sponsor of the charter school or the board.
Can you, just for the sake of the audience understands, a public body is also the governing board of the charter school.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It specifies that the applicability of the 50% residency requirement applies to all public charter schools that are operating prior to, on, or after the effective date of the Act, unless they have a waiver with the State Board of Education. And then it establishes the Online Learning Task Force. It specifies the membership of 13 that will be jointly appointed by the Speaker and the Senate President. It specifies what the task force will work on, the report they will prepare, and requires that that task force introduce legislation. And it also specifies that the moratorium on new virtual that new charter schools apply specifically to virtual schools only. I hope that's helpful.
Okay. Do we have a motion on the Dash 23 amendments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the Dash 23 amendments into House Senate Bills 767A.
It has been moved that the Dash 23 amendments be adopted into 767A. Discussion. The chair will enter this discussion. This bill arrived from the Senate Education Committee after four public hearings in that committee. The amendments to the bill are largely focused on actually not being permissive in the sense of answering some of the questions that we believe need to be answered. It is very directive to the legislature to actually come back to the 2010 session, not the 2011 session, to come back to the 2010 session with a recommendation. The task force will be formed, it will accept public testimony, and it will be making a recommendation to the 2010 supplemental session of the legislature. Any additional discussion on the amendments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your amendment. I really appreciate the expediency of the legislation to be proposed for the 2010 session, having served with this bill, with the committee administrator on the Committee of Education. That was one of the issues, is to get this process going so that students and others are not held in limbo any longer than is necessary. And your amendment, I think, helps provide a sense of urgency to that, and I really appreciate that. There are a number of things in the underlying bill that I still have some very deep concerns on, and the work group, I think, will help resolve some of those issues sooner rather than later. The other issue that that I would say is that I'm a little disappointed in the membership of the committee that works on it. And I had suggested some that were incorporated in the A. Gross edition, and interestingly enough, are not there in the new amendment. And I just think as we have all the people that are represented in this, they all represent traditional education and their that administration, and no one represents specifically the virtual charter schools that we're talking about. They say charter schools, but doesn't say virtual charter schools. And most disappointing, none of the 13 members represents the children who are in these schools. It all is the status quo who is working on this issue. So I would hope that those who are appointed to this task force will keep in mind that the objection is education of children, and their interests need to be represented by somebody rather than just the interests of those in the traditional school system.
Okay. Any additional discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Atkinson.
Mr. Chair, I'm pretty skeptical of this whole thing. Four public hearings, 23 amendments, and a task force, which I'm always skeptical of because the Oregon, every Oregonian has two votes to send two Oregonians to be on a 90-member task force called the legislature. When I read it, who's at this bill is at the request of the school board administrators, the American Federation of Teachers, the Oregon School Employees Association, and the OEA, it seems like the big guys are just picking on the little guys. That's all this seems to, because I've never heard of a problem with charter schools, I've never heard of a problem with virtual schools. This just looks like a turf battle. No one has ever written to me and said, boy, there's a huge problem with virtual charter schools. So this to me just looks like a classic big guys thumping on the little guys because they can. And I won't be supporting it.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Atkinson. Any additional comments?
I would like to make one more.
Yeah.
And just response to Senator Atkinson, I appreciate his comments, but being the representative of the Education Committee on this committee now, I would say, Senator, we did identify some very serious issues in education. What we couldn't identify or agree upon and what was the extent of how to resolve those issues. And so I think this process is very important, and I certainly concur with you, however, is that we have to do this in an appropriate way and make sure that those people who are most affected, who are the kids, and we heard from many that was very persuasive that this was making a difference in their lives, that they be represented. And I appreciate the chair's amendment that is going to expedite that process, and one will have to watch very carefully to make sure those interests are watched.
Okay. Any additional discussion? Seeing none, can the committee assistant call the roll?
And the motion, Mr. Chair, is for
the motion is on the dash 23 amendment.
Yes.
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator
Burton?
Aye.
No.
Aye. Motion passes. Do we have a motion on the bill as amended?
Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 767 as amended with the dash 823 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senate Bill 767 as amended has been moved to the floor as with a due pass recommendation. Any additional discussion? Yes, Senator Metzger.
Thank you. I will be voting yes in committee on that. I reserve the right to vote no on the floor. I still have some concerns about this bill, but I think it's an important one for the Senate to be having a discussion on the floor of the Senate.
Okay. Any additional discussion? Would the committee assistant please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson.
No.
Senator Burton.
Aye.
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Senator Perioli.
No.
Chair Devlin.
Aye. Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just would like to serve notice of a possible minority report.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. Notice is noted for the record. I believe, is Gina here? Okay, I'm going to reopen the work session on 519. Senator Farioli, Legislative Council has been researching your issue, and I believe we'll be able to provide you an answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My name is Gina Zedlick from Legislative Council. So in the absence of a definition of that word under PGE versus BOLI, you just use the common sense plain language meaning, and so that would be, you know, genuine, legitimate, that kind of thing. I think that's all that, because it's not defined in the bill as far as I know, that would be the meaning of bona fide.
Could I ask for a contextual definition, Mr. Chairman? Let me give an example.
Yes.
Bona fide, as in the movie O Brother, Where Art Thou? A bona fide suitor?
Chair Devlin, Senator Farioli, I haven't seen that movie.
You're the only one. I recommend it.
That's a good response.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is... No disrespect intended to the skill of legislative counsel. I don't think bona fide has any meaning at all. And as a matter of fact, I don't think you can differentiate between a bona fide and a non-bona fide religious institution or organization. I even wonder about the other definition that we discussed earlier, but... Mr. Chairman, I think we have ambiguity of purpose as well as definition in this.
Okay. Any additional questions since I've reopened the work session? interfere with. Any additional questions here?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, and we don't have a...
We do have a motion.
We do have a motion on the floor of... yes, I do pass recommendation on the floor. Senator Burdick. This is under discussion.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do, as you know, I do oppose this bill. I plan to oppose it on the Senate floor, but today I will be casting a courtesy yes vote to get this to the floor so we can allow that discussion to take place.
Yes. Any additional discussion on the motion? Will the committee assistant please call the roll?
I'm a bona fide no.
Aye.
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferraioli.
No.
Chair Devlin.
Aye. Motion passes. Senator Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Is there something you would like to note for the record?
Stay procedurally correct, Mr. Chair. I'd like to serve notice of a potential minority report.
Thank you very much, Senator.
And members of the committee, you will find in your packet on Senate Bill 519 written testimony from the Oregon Association of Nurseries.
It just came in.
Okay.
For the record, just so that people know it, for the record, 2005 will be carried by Senator Burdick. SB 519 will be carried by Senator Rosenbaum. SB 767 will be carried by Senator Haas and myself, unless Senator Metzger wanted to volunteer, but...
Might not be the best choice.
Okay. And the bill that we did before that, HB 3033A, who was Metzger? Senator Metzger, can you carry that?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And while we are trying to get gathered for our next group of hearings here, I just wanted to make a couple of comments. We are in the closing days of this legislative session. This is the Rules Committee. The Rules Committee, as you get to the close of legislative sessions, I can remember one of my first appearances in the Rules Committee. I had worked an entire session to get a bill passed. It took almost 3 months to get a hearing in the Rules Committee after it had had hearings and passed overwhelmingly in the House. It took 58 seconds for my hearing and work session in the Rules Committee. That is the way the Rules Committee operates in the end of the session. So if people think that we are moving rapidly here at any time, it is simply the nature of this committee and will become more the nature of this committee as we move towards sine die. In fact, if you will look at the bottom of our agenda, you will see a note, a possible consideration of committee bills. That is the sine die resolution introducing it.
And possibly other bills, Mr. Chair.
Yes, and possibly others. But today it's just sine die. So, let's see. I'm going to do what should be a relatively easy, I don't know where the committee is, but we have no one signed up. House Bill 2667A. Could the committee administrator, that's a public hearing, committee administrator, could you give a brief overview?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2667A requires the Secretary of State to verify residence of candidate for state senator or state representative in specific circumstances, directs Legislative Administration Committee to make software and hardware used for redistricting available to the Secretary to verify residences. It comes to you on a 602 vote from the House Committee on Rules and a 60-0 vote from the House floor.
Not anymore.
Okay. Members of this committee might remember the history of how this bill came about.
Sure do.
we have any questions, we're still in public hearing. The Secretary of State's representative here is to speak if you have any questions. Okay. If you do not, I will close the work session, or close the public hearing, open the work session. Do we have a motion? 2667A.
Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2667A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, it's been moved that 2667A be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, the last time Secretary of State Bill Bradbury verified my address, I lost my house. So I'm a little nervous. Keep moving, Senator. Stay one step ahead of the posse this time.
There's no way I'm supporting this bill.
Well,
that was the most partisan, dirty
thing I think I've ever had to face for this $1,400 a month job, and I'm not about to support this bill.
Okay. Since we've been in the legislature a long time, that has increased to $1,801.
Oh. Finally afford that cosmetic surgery I'm after.
Free tax.
But as you remember, as everyone remembers, this is probably prompted by an issue we had in the last general election. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Since it would be possible for the line in my district to move 300 miles in any direction, I'll be supporting this.
Okay. I think you might be requesting some changes in your district. You like it a little smaller?
Mr. Chairman, it went from 17,000 square miles to 34,000 square miles in the last redistricting, so have at it.
You know, Mr. Chair, maybe we could direct the Department of Energy by rule to reduce the carbon footprints and let them redistrict and they can tell us what they did.
I think while we are still on... Okay.
Germaneness, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Okay, it's been moved that 26678 to the floor with the pass recommendation. Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I object.
Okay. Senator Atkinson objects. Motion passes. Do I have a volunteer to be a carrier?
Sure.
Do I have another volunteer to be a carrier? Senator Metzger will carry us. Okay. We're now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3451A. Can the committee administrator give a brief overview?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3451A allows county clerk to electronically scan ballots into a vote tallying system noticing in the seventh day before the date of an election in accordance with security plan approved by the Secretary of State, requires county clerk to add security procedures to county election security plan for electronically scanned ballots before the date of an election, requires county clerk to conduct public certification tests immediately prior to scanning ballots, prohibits electronic scan of ballots prior to date of election unless Secretary of State reviews and approves security plan, requires preparatory test of machine and public certification test of vote tallying system to be conducted no later than 7 days before an election. Comes to you from the House Rules Committee 602 and from the House Floor 42, 4, and 14 excused.
Okay. We have three people signed up. I'm going to bring them all up at once. Annette Newingham, please come forward. Tim Scott, please come forward. And Ann Hannes, please come forward. And if you could identify yourself for the record. And because I have a lot of people waiting for a bill that's going to have a lot of testimony, if you can limit your testimony to about 2 to 3 minutes each.
For the record, my name is Annette Newingham. I'm Lane County Clerk. I'm here on behalf of the Lane County Board of Commissioners and the Oregon Association of County Clerks. This would allow us to have the ability to electronically scan ballots prior to Election Day without initiating any ballot count totals in order to expedite the count and therefore help support timely election results on Election Day. The states of Colorado, California, and Virginia have similar statutes. And I'll kind of briefly go over the key benefits or timelier ballot processing. As you may recall, last November election, we had a large amount of ballots that were participation. And because the process is where people, we do a pre-inspection process, and the pre-inspection process occurs through the time to what might be wrong with the ballot, but you can't really know what's actually going to occur through the ballot counters until Election Day. And then we find that we have to enhance and duplicate through the days afterwards, which slows the ballot count. So this would give timelier ballot processing. We'd have more significant election results on Election Day, less carryover ballots following Election Day, and higher overall accuracy in the processing of ballots because we had, like in Lane County, we would work 36 hours on Election Day straight in a row. We had different shifts, but some of us did work several days before we were able to go home. The accuracy does diminish when you do that. Reduction in election costs for larger counties, There, Washington County is a good example. They actually had to rent two equipment, two additional ballot scanners at a cost of $11,000 each, which is $22,000 that they would be able to save because they could do it ahead instead of after the fact. Safeguards are important, and I know this would be a concern of the legislators. Election officials would be required to submit procedures for early scanning in the security plan, already required to be submitted to the Secretary of State in statutes right now. We would also be required to have it approved by the Secretary of State, so we would submit it and they would have to review it and give us the approval. And current statutes already do provide that any premature vote tally release is an election offense under the statutes. Thank you for your testimony. I also encourage you to have Tim Scott is going to testify, and they did have the Secretary of State's office visit their office in Multnomah County and went through some of the procedures, and he could address some of the additional safeguards. Thank you.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, Tim Scott, Director of Elections, Multnomah County, and I won't repeat any of the testimony that my colleague just gave. Simply because everything she said is true. This will help us considerably to get timely election results to the public. I'll talk just for a minute about the Secretary's visit to my office. The Secretary and Deputy Secretary of State visited my office to go through a run-through of what our current process is with the ballot counters, and we use a system that 33 other counties in the state use, I believe. So it's the majority of the ballot counting tabulation equipment in the state, and we went through two different tests, one with our system configured as it would be for an election now, and then one as we would configure it in order to improve the security, so to avoid premature release of results. And the Secretary was satisfied that we could provide that level of security that would be necessary if we were to start scanning ballots 7 days prior to Election Day. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ann Hannes with the Association of Oregon Counties. For the reasons mentioned by the clerks, it'll save money and it'll result in a more accurate and timely tallying of the election results. We urge your support. Thank you.
Are there any questions for the parties testifying?
Questions, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Perioli.
As a layperson, with a tremendous respect for the work of the elections folks, isn't to scan to count, Mr. Chair?
Yes. It with two of the three systems that are in place in Oregon, the answer is yes. There is one system in Oregon that actually separates the two processes so that they can actually scan without tallying. They are actually already allowed to scan ballots 7 days prior to the election. The issue that will be addressed with this bill is that we're not saying that we're not counting as we're scanning, but what we're saying is we'll put additional security measures in place that will be laid out in our security plan, which must be approved by the Secretary of State's office in order to do this, in order to prevent the release of results prior to 8 p.m. on Election Day. So we'll add security.
Mr. Chairman, can any of you provide me with the definition of a secret? And I would be asking for the definition that is used commonly in this Capitol building.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I'm afraid you might have stumped me on that one. Secret, if your question is the release of the results and are who has access to it. I'd like to actually expand a little bit further on what Tim said, in that, like, for example, in our county, when that's run through the ballot counters, you don't see any election results. There are no election results. You do see how many ballots you have tabulated. It is tabulating, but you're not seeing the outcome of the results, which is a separate process of running a report. If I didn't have that capability, I'm very sure that the Secretary of State would not approve my ability to do the scanning early. But we actually have to run a separate report, which would not occur until Election Day. And all of the staff are under an oath of not releasing this, which is what I referred to in the statutes. So on Election Day, when we're tabulating currently, we have the same issue. We run the report just prior to releasing the results for the 8 o'clock. And there are some, such as myself, who have access just before 8 o'clock because I have to look at the results to make sure that they seem reasonable. If I had 110%, I'd have a problem, obviously. I mean, that's not likely.
I think they had that problem in King County in the last election cycle. Mr. Chairman.
No, I thought it was somewhere in Florida in previous...
seems to be going around.
No. But we fortunately do have, we do look at it, and we know what the returns are as we're going through and what we would be expecting the results to be. And we would look at that just to be sure that that was reasonable, and if not, we would be doing the investigation prior to releasing the results on the Internet to everybody on the 8 o'clock results. But that's usually just shortly before 8 o'clock.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of brief follow-ups, and then I will define what in this building is a secret. So who has the capability to run the tabulation report?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, who has the ability would vary as to each county. Who is the staff that's assigned to that task? I can address Lane County, for example. I have information system people, staff. There's two people that I have. I always operate in groups of two, and I have those two people run the console that run the reports. Those in my county happen to actually go through background checks. There's security. I have them sign oaths that they understand the election laws, that they can't release results before 8 o'clock. So we go through a rigorous situation for security purposes, which is part of our security plan. And some of it I can't talk about because it's secure.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So would it be evident that a tabulation report had been run?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, absolutely. All of the systems throughout Oregon have an audit trail for everything we do. Every time we run the test, every time we run the machines, when we stop the individual batches, there's an audit trail all the way through that process.
Mr. Chairman, a secret in this building is something that's told to one person at a time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Any additional questions for the parties? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will close if we can. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3451A. Is there a motion on 3451A?
Chairman.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Move House Bill 3451A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Burdick has moved House Bill 3451A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Please call the roll.
You okay? Yeah, I'm voting now.
No.
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Straight. No.
Motion passes.
And Mr. Chairman, because of the relative tightness of the relating clause, we will not be serving notice for a minority report on this bill.
Yeah, you have me wondering what your proposal would be. Okay, I will now open a public hearing on SCR 16. Can the committee administrator give a brief overview?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. SCR 16 congratulates Portland Trail Blazers on success of 2008-2009 NBA season.
Senator Carter. Senator Carter, as you know, please identify yourself for the record.
Chair, Vice Chair, good afternoon. My name is Margaret Carter. I represent Senate District 22 in North Northeast Portland. I am, on behalf of the Oregon Legislative Assembly and the people of the state of Oregon, I am excited and honored to bring to you Senate Concurrent Resolution 16 to congratulate the Portland Trailblazers in their winning season as the new co-champions of the Northwest Division of the Western Conference and their contributions to the community off the court. And, Mr. Chairman and colleagues, making the playoffs. Blazermania is back. I'm glad to report that to you.
Oh, sure.
15,000 people gathered in a rally to cheer the Blazers on into the NBA playoffs.
Yeah.
Sold out 71 consecutive games, more money for the state. People came from all over the state to these games. Guard Brandon Roy was selected for the NBA All-Star Game. Head coach Nate McMillan was named Western Coach of the Month in April 2009. This franchise won the prestigious 2008 Turnkey Prism Award from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst at Eisenberg School of Management, the Make It Better Community Outreach Initiative. The Blazers are on the move, and I can say to you, Mr. Chairman, the work that they did in our schools this year was just outstanding. The work they did with supplying schools with uniforms and different activities in our community was just an outstanding feat. They worked well with Head Start program in our community and have done just an excellent job, and had a new team with new young men who this state, with whom this state can feel very proud of. Oregon is home to the Northwest Division champions, and SCR 16 salutes the Blazers for their outstanding accomplishments. And, Mr. Chairman, I ask you and this committee to join me in saluting our Trailblazers, an important part of our economic, social, recreational, and sports world, as well as our community life. I feel as if our pride is rising and Blazermania is alive. And Mr. Chairman, with the permission of you and the committee, I would like to read a letter to you from the Portland Senator Council, dear Senator Devlin and co-chair. Members of the committee, we are writing in support of SCR 16, congratulating the Portland Trailblazers on the successes of the 2008-2009 season. With 54 wins, the six most regular session victories in the history of the team, and having made it to the NBA playoffs for the first time in 6 years, this was a truly historic season for the Trailblazers. The team succeeded in exciting people in Portland and throughout the state for the entire season, playing for sold-out crowds in 71 consecutive games. Through both their on-court success and community involvement, the Trailblazers have succeeded in capturing the imaginations of Portlanders and Oregonians alike. For this, we feel they deserve to be commended. The city of Portland is enormously proud of the Trailblazers. We look forward to watching them progress in the coming years, building on the foundation of all their hard work. We urge you to support SCR 16, signed by the mayor of the city of Portland and the other five commissioners. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Carter. Any questions for Senator Carter? Senator Metzger.
Well, Senator Carter, I appreciate you bringing this forward, and you might want to stay around because my good colleague to my left has been busy with minority reports, and I wonder what he might do on this one. So.
Well, don't get too late. Too creative, my friend, and support me. I would appreciate that much. Because I can see in you and Jason's eyes, you're always thinking about how are we going to attack this one. But I want you to attach.
It's about building bridges, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter, yes, if it was an SGR and not an SCR, I would be worried.
I'm disappointed she didn't come in here with one of those air cannons that shoots T-shirts or something.
Well,
I mean, seriously, did we outlaw those in here?
Yeah, I mean,
somewhere?
You'd be surprised what might happen once you pass the bill.
Uh-huh. Well,
yeah.
I look to be surprised.
I'd be more afraid of what might happen if we don't.
Okay. Any additional questions for Senator Carter? Seeing none, thank you very much
thank
for coming
you
here
very
today.
Much. Thank
I have
you.
No one else signed up. I will close the public hearing. Do we have a motion on SCR 16? Excuse me. I'll open a work session on SCR 16. Do we have a motion on SCR 16?
I think Senator Farioli and I would both love to make a motion to move SCR.
One of you, I'll take it as from you.
Senator 16 Atkinson. With a do adopt recommendation.
Okay, so SCR 16 has been moved to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Motion to move to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, motion passes. Senator Carter, will you carry?
I will, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Now, 3254. I will open a public hearing on 3254. Senator Nelson, will you come forward, and can the committee administrator give a brief overview, and can we see if Representative Jensen can return to the committee?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3254 allows radio and data communication districts to be formed as special districts within all or part of one or more of the counties, authorizes districts to acquire, maintain, and operate voice and data communication systems for use by public safety agencies within their boundaries, authorizes districts to contract with the United States for acquisition and operation of radio and data communication facilities and related property effective 91st day following signing die. There is a no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. Came to you from the House Rules Committee on an 8-0 vote and off the House floor on a 60-0 vote.
Senator Nelson, good afternoon. Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. I'll try and there's too much humor on this in this. Can't keep up with this. This bill is really was brought to us coming out of my Senate district and partially out of our representative districts also to allow radio and data communications. It's something that it's going to tie in probably with the public safety and public health. I have a couple of folks in the audience, Sheriff Ken Macklot from Marl County and Mike Roxbury and Sean Housley. You could probably talk to you in much greater depth on this thing. You know, it's all tied around the Umatilla Chemical Depot. It's going to be shutting down shortly, and so we're going to have to figure out some way how we're going to be able to fund this thing. And so this is going to allow the community itself to go out and try and raise the funds through some sort of special district. So that's the basic of it. And I could go into a lot of long, detailed conversation, but you guys are in a lot of hurry, and maybe you'd like to talk with some of the folks from Eastern Oregon.
Any questions for Senator Nelson? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here this afternoon. We'll go to Mr. Sean Halsey. And Michael Roxbury, and can Ann Haynes come forward also? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I can maybe can make one other statement. The Association of Oregon Counties handed me this sheet, and they wanted, I think they're having you, or this will be a part of the record, okay, in support of this bill.
Please start at your leisure.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, House Bill 3254 is simply an effort for us to find a way to fund a radio system that was built on our behalf due to the destruction of the weapons at the Chemical Depot. FEMA spent $14 million building that system. When the CSIP program closes out, we are going to be burdened with taking care of it and operating it for the future. And we've looked at a variety of ways to do that. The only way that really makes any good sense is to form a special district. When we went to look at that issue, we discovered that there's actually no enabling legislation in the OARs or the ORSs that allow a special district to exist for the purpose of maintaining and operating a radio system. You could have a fire district or a school district or an ESD, but you couldn't have a radio district. So 3254 is an attempt to get that legislation enacted so that we can go back then and try to convince our communities that we need to form this district to support the system.
For the record, can you please identify yourself?
Michael Roxbury, Fire Chief, Umatilla Rural Fire Protection District, and Chair of the 450 Radio Advisory Board.
Okay. Mr. Halsey.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Sean Halsey. I'm the Communications Coordinator for Umatilla County Emergency Management. And I'm basically here to answer technical questions. I refer to the second attachment of the testimony submitted. It shows that before the CSIP program and before the communication system existed, we had a group of 20 to 25 towers in our area that were all broadcasting public safety traffic on different frequencies. After the system was deployed, we have seven towers on seven channels. It's a lot more efficient and effective communication system. And that's the end of my comments.
Okay. Any questions for either Mr. Roxbury or Mr. Halsey? Seeing none, thank you both for coming here today. And my understanding is Ms. Haynes has actually just introduced written testimony and is not testifying. Or is she coming forward? I don't see her, so it's just the written testimony. Thank you very much. I'm going to close this public hearing, but potentially reopen it should Representative Jensen return. If he doesn't return, then I will open a work session and see if there's a motion on the bill. I'm going to open a public hearing on HJM 22.
Mr.
Can the committee administrator give a brief overview?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HJM 22 condemns acts of violence based on sexual orientation, gender identity, and other personal characteristics, calls on public institutions to remain vigilant against such acts, requests passage of local law enforcement hate crimes prevention acts to aid state and local jurisdictions in investigating and prosecuting bias-motivated violent crimes based on race, color, religion, national origin, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability. It comes to you today from the House Rules Committee on a 7-0-1 vote and from the House floor on a 59-0-1 vote. You have a no revenue impact and a no fiscal impact on the measure.
Ms. Roche, will you come forward, and Mr. Johnston, will you come forward? Please begin at your leisure and identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maura Roach. I'm representing Basic Rights Oregon here today, and we're testifying in support of HJM 22, which would memorialize Congress to pass the Matthew Shepard's Hate Crimes Act. And with me today is a board member from Basic Rights Oregon, Stephen Johnson, to offer testimony on the bill. Thank you for taking the bill so quickly.
Thank you. Mr. Johnston.
Good afternoon, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify to you today. My name is Stephen Johnston. I serve as a board member for Basic Rights Oregon. Basic Rights Oregon is the statewide advocacy organization for gay, transgender, and allied community. We represent tens of thousands of Oregonians from every corner of the state. I am here to testify in support of HJM 22. HJM 22 urges Congress to pass the Matthew Shepard Act, which would ban anti-gay and anti-transgender violence and strengthen hate crimes protections as a whole. This memorial was prompted by a hate crime that took place just weeks ago in Seaside. Two men, Samson Deal and Kevin Pedersen, were visiting the Oregon coast from Washington State on their spring break. They wandered away from an evening campfire when they ran into a group of four strangers who asked if they were gay and then called them fags. Samson and Kevin were brutally beaten and left unconscious on the beach. Seaside Police Chief Bob Gross told the Portland Mercury that Seaside Police have, quote, had some hate crimes before, mostly threats, but I have never dealt with anything this serious. In a letter to Eugene community leader Alan Brown, Chief Gross wrote, "This was clearly a hate crime, and to call it anything else would have been a disservice to the victims and to the community." The letter from Chief Gross is attached to my testimony for your reference. Sadly, Samson and Kevin's case is not an isolated one. According to the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs, 2,430 anti-lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender hate crimes were reported nationally in 2007. And in 2007, we saw the greatest number of anti-LGBT murders in 8 years. 21 gay and transgender people were murdered in the United States in 2007, more than double the number in 2006. At even greater risk than gay individuals are transgendered people. In 2001, right here in Oregon, Loni Okoruru was found bludgeoned to death in a field south of Hillsboro. The Washington County's Sheriff's Office told press at the time they believed her murder to be an anti-transgender hate crime. Local law enforcement shared with Brough staff that, quote, the condition of the body left no question as to the motive of the attack. Loni's murder remains unsolved. As with any crime, the guilty parties aren't always brought to justice, but when they are, we know that hate crimes laws work. Just days ago, a Colorado court found a defendant guilty of a similar crime, the brutal murder of Angie Zabata, an 18-year-old transgender woman. None of us should be subject to the senseless violence that Samson, Kevin, Loney, and Angie experienced. The Matthew Shepard Act makes it clear that no one should fear for their safety just for being themselves. And in passing HJM 22, the Oregon legislature can lead the way to a safer America for all of us. Today, you can send a message to Oregonians across the state that wherever you live, wherever you work, wherever you travel, you deserve to be safe. Again, on behalf of Basic Rights Oregon, I urge you to pass HJM 22, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions for either Ms. Roach or Mr. Johnston? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here today. I will close the public hearing on HJM 22, open a work session on HJM 22. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I move HJM 22 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. HJM 22 has been moved to the floor with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, motion passes. Okay. Motion passes. I will carry. Colleagues, we're trying to see if Representative Jensen wants to return to testify on the other bill. So what I'll explain to the audience here today is I'm going to open a hearing on the bill everybody has been waiting for.
Is this the time where everybody's in line?
No. But what we will do is open that public hearing, and if Representative Jensen reappears, then I will basically close that public hearing, reopen the other public hearing, and then come back to this one. But for now, I'm going to open a public hearing on HB 2430. Representative Schaffer, please come forward and first to allow the committee administrator to give a brief overview.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am going to just tell you what's in your packet, and then I'm going to defer to the committee administrator who worked this bill on the House side. You will find in your packet the dash A, 2, 3, and 4 amendments. You will find written testimony from Representative Holby. You will find also written testimony from the Housing and Community Services. Teresa Van Winkle is the committee administrator on the House Business and Labor Committee, and she will take you through the SMS and explain the differences between the amendments.
Thank you.
Okay. Please.
Thank
proceed.
You. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. House Bill 2430 establishes parameters for the application exemption of prevailing wage rates on a mixed commercial and residential construction project that predominantly provides affordable housing and also establishes rulemaking authority to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and there's an emergency clause effective upon passage. Committee members, on the second page of your preliminary staff measure summary is a matrix of the three amendments before you. They are all essentially the same. They do make a couple of technical changes, such as clarifying the definition of a podium and changes terminology from floors to stories. The main difference between the three amendments is in the prevailing wage rate exemption. I won't go into details. I know witnesses in the audience will do that. So I'll just stop there for now.
Okay. Representative Schaffler, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Schaffler, State Representative, House District 48, Happy Valley, Outer Southeast Portland, and Chair of the House Business and Labor Committee. It's a really a simple bill, actually. Currently, all affordable housing, four stories and down, and in some communities, five stories and down, is exempt from prevailing wage. Some nice people want to put affordable housing along the max lines in places like that in Oregon, and they want to add a commercial floor on the first floor to add to the quality of life and add amenities and the best, wisest use of the land. All it does is, in my opinion, is if there is a commercial floor on the first floor, it prevails the construction of that first floor. A lot of folks are going to come up and say, well, they should prevail the whole project then. Well, if we want to prevail affordable housing, that's one thing, but it wouldn't change anything on the next three floors. It still would be exempt. There's some funding, financing issues. If you do prevail the whole thing, personally, I would prevail everything under the sun if I had my way, but I'm not king of the world. So I think it's a fairly straightforward bill. It's been said that it adds confusion on how you determine what part of the project appraisals or not. Currently, the commissioner has the ability, Commissioner Bureau of Labor and Industry has the ability and does divide up projects. So we're already doing this in the state. Now you know everything I know about it, and you're going to hear from a lot of nice people on both sides, and I know you'll enjoy that. And if you have any questions, I'll try and answer them to the best of my ability.
Any questions for Representative Shoffley? Yeah. I see no questions.
How are you?
Thank you very much for coming this afternoon.
Thank you.
Representative Dembro, are you here to testify?
I am.
Please come forward. And just identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Senator Devlin. Senators, I'm Representative Michael Dembro from House District 45. That's Northeast Portland to Park Rose. And I'm here to speak in opposition to this bill. I do so reluctantly because I'm a passionate supporter of affordable housing. But I'm also a passionate supporter of the principle of prevailing wage, particularly when public dollars are involved. And they are, and presently projects like this, the workers are paid at the prevailing wage rate. And I will argue to you that that should continue. I understand the desire of people trying to put these projects together to keep their costs as low as possible, but we should not be doing that on the backs of the project workers. As I was weighing my own position on this bill, I checked with some of the advocates for affordable housing, asking them about how necessary this really was, trying to hear from them that projects would not be able to go forward under the current circumstances. And instead, actually, what I heard from them was a desire to, in all cases, exempt the prevailing wage. That is, so that it would apply not only to the upper floors, but also the bottom floor. In fact, what I heard from them was that having two different systems would actually confuse and make their job more difficult. And I'll just quickly quote an excerpt from one who was talking about his project down at St. Vincent de Paul. Quote, "It adds yet another layer of complexity to an already very complex project. We have to submit these plans to Boley, and then workers must keep track of their time and in the office the wages based on where they are working in the building. This may not sound difficult, but in actuality it is very time-consuming and leaves a lot of room for error. My biggest fear is the uncertainty of the Boley mixed-use process. From our conversations, however, I fear that once plans are completed and submitted, there will be disagreements which will result in huge delays and huge cost implications. Moreover, and more importantly, this adds yet another risk factor for my investor and permanent lender." And that is, you know, what he is afraid of is exactly what, in the final form of this bill, we're looking at. Instead of making the system easier, in many ways it will make it more difficult. And just in terms of the principle of prevailing wage, this bill really violates the fundamental principle of equal pay for equal work. We should not be forcing a worker to give up health benefits and a much lower wage when he or she climbs a ladder up to the second floor, nor should we be compelling the people who are going to live in that residential housing to have work done by a different group of workers, arguably a less skilled group of workers, as as the work moves up to the second floor. So for all these reasons, Senators, I urge you not to move this bill forward. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Dembro? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here this
thank
afternoon.
Thank you.
Okay. Next two people I will call up is Bob Shipwreck and Michael Anderson.
Good Chair Devlin.
We had a panel of three.
Yes, please. Please proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary, Oregon Building Trades Council. I'm here in support of House Bill 2430. What I wanted to do this morning is give you a very brief kind of history of where we've been with this. This is actually something that some of you might recall because we thought we passed this bill last session. It has to do with what are known as public-private partnerships. This is where the government puts some money, land, you name it, into a project generally to help a public purpose, such as Representative Schaffler mentioned, along light rail areas. For instance, you'll have commercial on the first floor and then perhaps two or three floors of affordable housing above. There are sizable public investments in some of these projects. I looked at the some of the RFPs, for instance, that PDC has. They have apprenticeship requirements, minority contracting requirements. It looks like a public works. For many years, there was a lot of confusion, litigation, very hard feelings over why these projects paid no prevailing wage whatsoever. And there was a committee formed. I was on it. This was 4 years ago where we tried to work this situation out. Why is it so difficult? Because Oregon has a somewhat unique law, I'm told. Obviously, we learned this on our committee. We have what's known as a two-part test. You have to, a public contracting agency either has to do both contract for or carry on a project, and then there has to be a use of public funds in that project, both things. What was going on prior to passage of House Bill 2140 last session was that the public contracting agencies were simply saying, well, we don't have a contract to do this. That's between the developer and the contractor. It was a way to get around the statute. There was at the same time, there was a major court case called the Tin Roof case. Don't ask me why it got called that, but that's what its name was. Commissioner Gardner at that time filed a lawsuit in Portland over one of these types of projects, believing that he could litigate and get an answer to this vexing problem of when do you pay prevailing wage and when do you not on these types of projects. That case eventually was lost in court. I was at the courthouse that day, walked across the street to City Hall, talked to the mayor and some of the city council people. There was a hearing set. The mayor and city council then directed the Portland Development Commission to form a committee. That committee was formed. There were three hearings, and they came up with what they called the wage policy. It's essentially what was in 2140 and is in front of you today. The basic deal involved in this is that you would exempt low-income housing from any prevailing wage. It never was prevailed before unless there were federal funds involved. There also is no real state prevailing wage for residential in that we adopt the federal HUD rates is what we call them, which are extraordinarily low in parts outside of the metropolitan area. In fact, some of them are below our state minimum wage. The commercial buildings, straight-up commercial buildings, if there was over $750,000 of public funds invested, would be prevailed at the BOLI commercial rate. So what we did on these mixed-use projects is said at PDC, and in what we thought we said in 2140 was that the commercial portion of these buildings would be BOLI commercial, and then the low-income housing above would be exempt. We had to take the agreement reached with the Portland Development Commission, obviously, to the legislature because there was no statutory authority to do this. That was 2140. You folks all voted for that bill last session. We had a coalition of housing, of low-income housing, contractors, labor, and BOLI staff began drafting pardon me, they drafted the bill that eventually passed the legislature after a long process. I wanted to share with you just one comment I had with an attorney just down the street, Bill Gary. He's a principal with Harang Long Law Firm before the legislature started. He's the attorney firm that was representing the developers in the two. There was, by the way, another court case at the Salem Convention Center right down the street. It, too, eventually was lost. I asked Bill, I said, this is what we're trying to do here, is to get this mess cleaned up so we'll quit litigating. Now, remember, his is the firm that was doing the litigating, and so I was somewhat surprised when he said, Bob, we can fight this out in court for years, but it takes people with certificates of election on the wall to get this thing straightened out. I thought that was something good to share with you. After this session was over, Michael Anderson and I went up to see Dan Gardner, Commissioner, and he informed us that there was a drafting mistake regarding mixed use. It's probably not surprising. We had multiple authors of the bill, changes at Legislative Council, changes at the Deputy Office at Boley, and so there was a lot of people involved, and I was afraid something like that might happen. We were told then to go back to the legislature. We then began working on what you have in front of you today, House Bill 2430. It's been almost 2 years of work. I must say mixed use was always a major topic and intended to be decided by this legislation. There has been a consistent message on the fix for over 3 years. The details may vary, but the bill today is better than the bill we had from last session. It is clear there were a lot of amendments adopted and still to be adopted to address concerns of individuals and some of the mistakes in drafting that were made. I also want to say that good faith negotiating must be respected, and honest mistakes in drafting should not lead to a gotcha process in this Capitol building. The legislature must clarify the current situation to bring certainty for these projects. Boley, as Representative Schaffler just said, has been splitting projects for years. They just did one a couple months ago, University Place. This is not a new process. Is it the cleanest method? No, but it's probably the fairest, in our opinion. Today, as a result of 2140, I just wanted to let you know that well over $100 million a year of commercial projects are now being prevailed, as they should be, and we just simply want to do what we thought we did last session, repair this bill, and I think it's a good deal for everybody. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Please proceed.
Chair Devlin and members of the committee, my name is Michael Anderson, and I represent the Oregon Opportunity Network. The Oregon Opportunity Network is a statewide association of over 40 nonprofit affordable housing and community development organizations. Our members help build sustainable communities, develop affordable housing for working families, people with disabilities, seniors, and others, and provide economic opportunities for Oregonians who are struggling to meet their basic needs. Oregon On has been working on the issues addressed in HB 2430 in partnership with the Oregon Building Trades and the Association of General Contractors since 2006. We've worked with these partners on House Bill 2140, which Bob just went into, so I'll skip the details there. But certainly 2430 fixes an omission from 2140. As Bob mentioned, before 2007, all privately owned affordable housing structures were exempt from state prevailing wage. On House Bill 2140 was intended to address these larger commercial construction projects with this specific exemption for small affordable housing projects, including small mixed-use projects. The idea was that localities require ground floor commercial in the development of these housing projects, often because of their location and proximity to transportation corridors, main streets, where that's part of the design. Oftentimes, the occupants of these commercial spaces are not your Starbucks or private industry, but rather a clinic that's offering drug and alcohol counseling to the residents in the building or childcare services to the residents of the building. There are only about 3 to 5 projects a year that would be impacted by this legislation. However, even though that's a very small group of projects that would be impacted, it's crucial to reinstitute the fairness and consistency and clarity on the application of prevailing wage. The development of affordable housing, particularly housing that serves the lowest income seniors and people with disabilities, families with children, often requires 3 to 4 years of pre-development work and can involve upwards of 12 funding sources. In these complex real estate deals, uncertainty can be a killer. Furthermore, for small rural projects, often in communities without developers who are accustomed to managing prevail projects, the application of prevailing wage can discourage contractors from bidding on projects because of their unwillingness to do the paperwork required when a project prevails. It's not something I necessarily understand why. This is just the practice that we understand that goes on. The inconsistency of the application of prevailing wage has made life very difficult and nerve-wracking for my members. It's a brief illustration of the climate in which my members have been operating since 2005. One of my members this morning, when I was calling to get details of projects, asked me not to talk about any of the projects of her deal because she was afraid there would be some sort of retaliation from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Whether or not that is accurate or correct, that's the climate that we've been operating under. And as an example of what I'm talking about, I sent a handout, which is a handout put together by the Bureau of Labor and Industries to show projects that are currently in the pipeline. And if you look at the project that's highlighted, you'll note that in the column that says covered without 2430, it says that this project would be covered because existing affordable housing exemption does not apply to reconstruction. Well, when we look at ORS 279C810 to Part D, in fact, actually reconstruction is specifically mentioned. Unfortunately, it's been this type of inconsistency and variation from the law that has caused a lot of consternation and project overruns and costs for my members. So what we are hoping is with the passage of 2430 to end this era of inconsistent application of prevailing wage law, to reinstate the fairness that was intended when HB 2140 was passed, and to go back into the normal business that we do, which is providing housing opportunity to those left behind by the private market. Thank you very much for your time, and I welcome any questions.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon. Thank you for sticking around. I'm Andrew Beyer. I am the current president of the Associated General Contractors. I am the vice president and partner of Walsh Construction Company. I'm representing both of those interests in my testimony this afternoon in favor of this bill. It's reasonably simple. I agree with Representative Schaffler. The state has two interests in this issue. One is to promote affordable housing, provide funding for affordable housing. The other is to make sure that people are being paid fair wages. In this particular situation, there's a compromise that has been developed over a long period of time with lots of different people's input, which is an attempt to try to create a compromise that works both for labor and for the affordable housing community. In this particular situation, where the developers and planners are required to include a commercial portion in a building, it is a different type of construction. And the reason that the difference of wages was encouraged in the mixed-use situation is because it is different activities and therefore would be compensated in different ways. Information that you've heard about there being no prevailing wage and that people will not get paid appropriate wages or receive benefits is not the case, certainly not the case for our company. And the situation essentially is that on the commercial portion of the project, that the people that were working in that section would get paid commercial wage, and in general, because there is federal funding in almost all of these projects, the people on the rest of the project would be getting federal prevailing wage. So it's not prevailing wage or no prevailing wage. It is actually whether it's commercial prevailing wage or residential prevailing wage. The other thing I think that's important to recognize is that the issue of certainty is critically important. I think Michael has talked about this, but what is these projects get teed up about two years ahead of time, And the variance on this cost, depending upon the size of the project, can be anywhere from 10 to 25% of the total cost of the project, which makes a huge difference both to the funders and to the developers, whether the nonprofit developers that are putting these projects together. So the attempt here has been to clarify the situation so that everyone would know with certainty which portion of the building would be paying prevailing wage and which portion of the building would be paying a lower prevailing wage. That's essentially the issue. And they would go into the process knowing that with certainty so that they could figure out what their budget was and what the uses in the building would be, adjust the project according to that, come up with their funding, and get the project built. What I can tell you is that over the last 5 years or 6 years is that because of this lack of certainty that many projects have been delayed. And as you all know, the construction industry at the moment is having a very serious downturn. There are projects on hold which this affects, and there are projects that are not being pursued until this is clarified. So it's my hope, again, as president of AGC and also as a person in a construction company that builds affordable housing, that the committee will vote and the legislature will pass this legislation to provide certainty and clarity. Last point, in terms of confusion with regards to labor rates and keeping track of all that, we've been doing this for 40 years. And I can tell you that on any given construction site, particularly where there are union laborers involved, there are upwards of 10 to 20 different labor rates that we keep track of on every project every day. So this is not a particularly complicating thing when people are working on prevailing wage jobs, when contractors are involved in prevailing wage jobs. It just comes with the territory. We do it. It's part of the process. It's not particularly complicated. Last part is that the specificity of the language to determine which portion would be prevailed in commercial as opposed to which part would be affordable housing is important because of the vagaries of the judgments that have come out from Bureau of Labor and Industries and the inconsistencies that have been there. This was something that they worked with us to help develop. Their staff was actually sat on the committee that worked on this process, and the idea was to try to provide absolute clarity as to what was the commercial part that would be prevailed in the commercial way and what would be the residential portion. So it's our opinion that this is trying to clarify the situation, to provide consistency and also fairness to the people that are working on the project doing different types of labor on the same project, which I would tell you has happened multiple times and will continue to happen with this bill passing. Okay. Appreciate the opportunity to come and testify. Be willing to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you for coming forward. What I'm going to do now is we will get to everybody that has signed up, but I'm going to go back and forth between proponent and opponent. So Cheryl Harris, Christy Hammond, and Jack Roy, if you would please come up. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cherry Harris. I'm a business representative of the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 701, which is a statewide construction trades local representing over 4,000 members statewide and their families. And I testify before you today at the direction of our business manager, Mark Holliday, representing the interests of our entire local in opposition to House Bill 2430A. I do have prepared copies of my testimony that I will distribute when I'm done. I also, along with it, have a one-page opposition paper that is endorsed by a number of trades and associations, and there was one that one endorser of this document that came in after that we had prepared the document, and that is the Northwest Council of Carpenters is also opposed. in addition to the ones on this paper. My history with this issue goes back to its beginning in 2006. I was personally involved in fostering discussions between representatives of certain trade unions and the affordable housing developers affiliated with the Community Development Network and the Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations. Prior to these discussions, the two sides, labor and the housing developers, had been continually pitted against each other by the Portland Development Commission to justify the agency's kind of unwritten, I believe, policy and practice of not applying prevailing wage rates to privately owned projects that are publicly funded. From the trade's perspective, that just flat is wrong. At the same time, the affordable housing developers were in a battle with Portland City Hall to get a 30% affordable housing set aside in urban renewal districts, and they wanted our help to get it. So both sides made a conscious effort to lay down the hatchet and call a truce. Just 2 short years ago, those discussions culminated in the housing developers' requested fix, HB 2140, that is now embedded in current law. From the very beginning, the basic premise behind those discussions and the developers' desired exemptions was that all affordable housing projects would fall under prevailing wage requirements, as they all used over $50,000 of public funds. And with that in mind, we worked together to develop criteria acceptable to both sides that allowed for some very limited affordability exemptions. Most importantly, the housing developers wanted a bright line to determine upfront whether or not prevailing wage requirements would apply. This had nothing to do with whether or not the project would pencil out or go forward. Instead, it was all about not being surprised at the back end of a 2 or 3 year planning process after the funding package was established and the project was well on its way down the construction path. Current law, post HB 2140, gives the developers that certainty at the front end of the planning process. Simultaneous to those conversations, and unbeknownst to some of us at the table, other wheels were turning to raise the public funding threshold on privately owned projects to $750,000 from $50,000. Had we known of this effort, I would venture to say the housing exemption discussions would have concluded very differently. I find it interesting that our neighbors to the north and south also have little Davis-Bacon laws that apply to all public and public-private work with much lower public thresholds than Oregon. There's a dollar threshold in Washington and $1,000 in California. It's very different. Those states exercise a direct link between the investment of public funds and the benefit of the commons and recognize that providing for the poor means not only putting a roof over people's heads, but also guaranteeing fair wages and benefits on publicly funded jobs. There's a connection. There's a tie to the dollar. We have not heard concerns from developers in those states that they need some special exemption under the law to gain certainty on the viability of their projects. I find it hard to believe that in these difficult economic times that they have any lesser need for affordable housing than we do, and their affordable housing projects seem to move forward. HB 2430A opens up a Pandora's box of confusion, splitting projects, undermining prevailing wage law, and exempting commercial work. It is unfair to workers on the project, and it doesn't fix anything. I strongly urge you to vote no on House Bill 2430A. Before I conclude, I would like to address the list that was provided by the Opportunity Network with the projects on it, because there were 8 projects that they provided that originally in testimony on the House side they said were on hold pending this legislation. And they said there were 4 or 5 projects. When we got the list, there were actually 8. And in fact, the list didn't say those projects were on hold. It said that they would be positively affected by 2430. And when we really sat down and analyzed the projects, here's the way they fell out. 2 of those projects are publicly owned projects. They are not exempt currently. They would not be exempt under 2430. They're publicly owned projects. 2 are likely exempt under current law already, and as such would be exempt under the amendment. are under the change. Two are covered under predetermination by BOLI, and they're moving forward. They've already started. They are not, in fact, on hold. They would not be affected by this legislation. And that includes the Clifford reconstruction, which was mentioned just a moment ago. There's another reason that actually is operating under a predetermination, that they were covered under prevailing wage law. And the other reason, it's not just that it's a reconstruction, it also is a mixed-use project. One of those projects is covered under a predetermination by BOLI that has not yet started, but it is close. It is not on hold. One project truly is on hold, and it may be exempt under 2430. However, I happen to know that the primary financier developer on that project is seeking union pension funding as part of that funding package, and I can't imagine that they wouldn't know that we would be, I can't imagine that they'd be seeking an exemption from prevailing wage law on that project if they think they're going to have it funded by union pension dollars. So, anyway, there are two in that list, two similar projects in the future may be affected under 2430. So I would be, thank you for your time and attention. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Please, the next person, then we'll go to questions to the panel.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. My name is Christy Hammond, and I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. Within the Wage and Hour Division is the Prevailing Wage Rate Unit, which is responsible for enforcing the prevailing wage rate law and investigating allegations of violations of the law. I participated in work group meetings last session relating to House Bill 2140 and also participated in meetings this session regarding House Bill 2430. I'm here to testify today regarding some of the technical concerns the Bureau of Labor and Industries has regarding House Bill 2430A. As the agency responsible for enforcing the prevailing wage rate law, BOLI opposes House Bill 2430A and the complicated standards it creates for applying the PWR law to mixed-use construction projects subsidized with public funds. Our understanding is that the intent of House Bill 2430 is to clarify application of the PWR law on projects with both affordable housing and commercial elements. Throughout the discussions in which I've participated, I have frequently heard the proponents of this legislation identify two main reasons for this legislation. I have repeatedly heard it been said that objections to coverage of these projects under the PWR law aren't about the wage rates themselves that are required, but rather uncertainty about whether or not the law applies to a project and paperwork requirements of the law. The affordable housing proponents have repeatedly stated that clarity regarding application of the law to affordable housing projects is imperative in obtaining necessary financing. I've gone in some detail in my written testimony explaining why House Bill 2430A actually complicates rather than clarifies coverage under the law, and I've also attached a summary to my testimony. And on the second page of that summary are some examples of various scenarios and how we understand the provisions of 2430A to apply to those various scenarios. Simply put, the current law is perfectly clear. Privately owned standalone affordable housing projects are exempt under the prevailing wage rate law. Mixed-use projects with commercial construction and more than $750,000 in public funds are not exempt. House Bill 2430A contains several confusing and inconsistent new criteria to be applied in determining whether a project is exempt or partially exempt under the law, and it frankly isn't written in a way that we believe anyone can easily understand or apply it. I would also note that based on questions raised during discussions about its intent and practical application, the bill has been back and forth to legislative council to rewrite several times to address situations that were either unclear or conflicting. In summary, what House Bill 2430A does is allow parts of a project with affordable housing to be covered under the law and parts to be exempt. Workers on the first floor of a building with commercial construction would be subject to the prevailing wage rate law, but then would be exempt when working on the second through fourth floors of the building. Electricians are the only trade that would be covered on the entire building if any part of the building is subject to the law, and surface parking and landscape work, which are normally covered on PWR projects, would always be exempt. For some reason, that is not clear on all projects, even if the law applies to other workers. Then there are different requirements for buildings with podiums that I won't go into. We really don't see how the provisions of House Bill 2430A add clarity or certainty to the law. In fact, we believe the criteria in House Bill 2430 are far more confusing and complicated than the current test and will be difficult to apply, not only by the Bureau, but by public agencies, developers, lenders, and contractors. And I want to take a second to clarify a point that's been raised in previous testimony, and that is the premise that the commissioner currently has the authority to divide up a project, a building, and have some of the building covered under the prevailing wage rate law and some of the building exempt. That's not the case. We have issued multiple rate determinations on a single building project, but we have never, and we don't have the authority to determine that part of a building is covered under the law and part of the building is not. With regard to the paperwork requirements of the law, this bill will actually make record-keeping more onerous for contractors on these projects. Contractors on projects subject to the prevailing wage rate law are required to file certified payrolls showing the number of hours worked and wages paid to employees on the project. If the PWR law applies to any part of a project, these certified payroll filing requirements are triggered. So in the first example of this summary we've put together, workers employed on the first floor of the building in the commercial space would be required to be paid prevailing wage, and the employer would be required to report these hours worked and amounts paid in certified payroll filings. Hours worked by the same employees on the second through fourth floors would be exempt, and the employer would not be required to pay PWR or report the hours worked on these floors. So if an employee works on multiple floors during the course of a work day or work week, the employer would be required to keep track of the number of hours worked on each floor in order to determine which hours to pay and report as PWR hours. So with the exception of electricians, the only craft that would be required to be paid PWR wages on the entire project in the first example, other workers who work on all floors in the example would be required to be paid the prevailing wage rate, including fringe benefits, for work performed on the first floor of the building, but could be paid as little as minimum wage with no fringe benefits for hours worked on the second through fourth floors. Bully believes it will be difficult for contractors to accurately track the number of covered and non-covered hours worked by the majority of employees on these mixed-use projects, particularly workers who work throughout the building on multiple floors. And we are concerned that it will be difficult for the Bureau to investigate disputes regarding where work was performed and the number of hours worked in each location. In conclusion, Bully opposes House Bill 2430A. We believe it would make it more difficult for developers, contractors, and Bully to determine whether and how the PWR law applies to these types of projects, more difficult for contractors to comply with the law, and more difficult for Bully to enforce the law. Thank you for allowing me to testify regarding this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Roy.
Hello, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. My name's Jack Roy. I'm a business rep from Labor's Local 296, and I'm here representing the Oregon and Southern Idaho District Council of Labor's, as he had prior commitments. So this is a letter from them, our Labor's, and anyway, we're strongly opposed to House Bill 2430A. This legislation would weaken prevailing wage rate law by expanding the existing exemption for affordable housing projects and allow certain public-funded mixed-use projects with commercial space to also be exempt under the law. While the Labor support the exemption for purely affordable housing projects, exists that exist in current law, we strongly oppose expanding this exemption and allowing it to apply to any portion of a mixed-use project comprised of both commercial and residential components. Under current law, no portion of a mixed-use building can be exempt from the PWR law. House Bill 2430A is a major step backward for labor and would allow workers on public works projects subsidized with public funds to be paid as little as minimum wage with no fringe benefits. As a trade, we feel that laborers are unfairly treated by this proposal and that our craft would be disproportionately harmed by provisions in this bill that allow for the first floor of a mixed-use building to be exempt from the PWR law. Much of the work done by laborers on a building construction project is located on the first floor and outside the building in its landscape, sidewalks, and surface paving. Laborers might be the most adversely affected of the trade workers because such a large proportion of the work on a mixed-use project, the first floor and outside, would be exempt under this proposal. Under current law, this work is not exempt from prevailing wage. Finally, we believe House Bill 2430A is contrary to its stated purpose to providing clarity regarding the application of PWR law to affordable housing projects. House Bill 2430A creates a confusing and convoluted application of PWR law that will most certainly increase confusion and uncertainty for developers, contractors, and workers. Thank you for your considering the opposition of laborers in Oregon to House Bill 2430A.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Harris, Ms. Hammond, or Mr. Roy? Seeing none, thank you all for coming today. I'm going to do something now so that you understand. I'm going to close this public hearing for like 3 minutes and then reopen it. But I'm looking so I always keep a quorum. So I will close this public hearing and I will reopen a public hearing on 3254. Colleagues, during our consideration of 3254, Representative Jensen was waiting here for Senator Nelson. When Senator Nelson arrived, Representative Jensen had to return to a committee, and we have been unable to locate Representative Jensen, but I'm sure he would like the bill to move. So I'm going to close this public hearing and open a work session on HB 3254.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I would move House Bill 3254 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. 3254 has been moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, motion passes. Senator Nelson motion passes.
Well, Richard,
let's do this.
I'm walking slow, man.
I move.
That's fine. It's fine.
You're okay.
It's fine.
Mr. Chairman, point of order.
Yes.
I count five senators at the dais.
Okay.
So that would look. That would be a unanimous vote.
Yes, it would. But I already hit the gavel and said it passed before he got here. So
I see, Mr. Chair.
The chair can make a motion, unless the Senator Farrelly would like to make the motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that rules be suspended and that we reconsider House Bill 3254.
Okay, it's been moved to suspend the rules to reconsider House Bill 3254. Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, Senator Atkinson, how do you vote on House Bill 3254?
Mr. Chairman, what was the result of the motion, please?
The motion passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Atkinson, how do you vote?
It's so rare today I've been able to. I just don't want to miss an opportunity to say aye.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson. Motion passes. Record that all five members of the Rules Committee voted in the affirmative. Senator Nelson will carry.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman,
before
we leave this issue,
yes.
Your graciousness is much appreciated.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you, Senator.
Now we will open to work session. I will open a work session for possible introduction of committee measures. The measure that is before you, would the committee administrator give a brief overview?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. LC 3837 is adjourning sine die. Regular session of 75th Legislative Assembly.
We will not be moving this measure to the floor today, but
I move we suspend the rules to do that.
I'd
the chair is taking that comment in jest, but is there a motion to introduce this measure?
Mr. Chair, move that LC 3837 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, it's been moved.
Mr. Chair, I will amend my motion, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move LC 3837 to be introduced as a committee bill.
That would have been much better.
Okay. It has been moves. Senator Farrell moves that LC 3837, dated 5/21/2009, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I think you owe your committee staff a debt of gratitude for her preventing you from moving the bill as it was accepting the motion as it was offered.
Well, she is. I probably would not have repeated the same motion, so then it would have been a question.
Don't take that back.
Okay. Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, the motion passes. Now I will reopen the hearing on 2430A. And we will go to Martha McClellan and Philip Duchow.
Good afternoon, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Martha McClellan. I'm the Executive Director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. We're a nonprofit housing provider with offices in Milwaukee. We currently provide housing every night to over 2,500 Oregonians with low incomes. And we do that in 16 Oregon counties, so we're fairly broadly based. But our home is certainly Clackamas County. I'm testifying today in support of House Bill 2430 that would help us move forward with some certainty on the prevailing wage issue. You've heard a fair amount of history today, and at the risk of repeating some of it and understanding that history is in the eye of the beholder. I've worked in the affordable housing industry now for 29 years, and I, in fact, began working in this industry in the realm of enforcing Davis-Bacon prevailing wage laws. Until 2005, no affordable housing project in Oregon had ever been interpreted to be covered by the prevailing wage laws. There was no change in the law in 2005. There was simply a new interpretation of the existing prevailing wage laws. At that point, our industry went into a great deal of uncertainty. There were projects that were prevailed after construction had been completed. There were projects that were prevailed when they were in construction, and projects that were prevailed while they were in the pre-development phase. Lawsuits ensued, projects were stalled, banks withdrew funding for projects. It was very difficult. That led to the work that the then Community Development Network and Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations, now the Oregon Opportunity Network, began with labor to provide some sense of clarity about how prevailing wage law should apply to affordable housing, when it should and when it should not. In 2007, we had a fairly simple principle, we thought. And, of course, the devil is in the details. The simple principle at that point was that projects that predominantly serve low-income people by providing them with affordable housing and are small should be exempted from the prevailing wage laws. Projects that didn't predominantly serve affordable housing for low-income people or were taller should be covered by prevailing wage laws. Fairly quickly on the heels of the 2007 Act, we began to see some of the weaknesses in that simple principle as it had been embodied in that bill. One of those principles was the issue of mixed-use projects. The agreement that we had with labor was actually very clear that predominant applied both to the physical characteristics of the building and to the residents that would be served in the affordable housing. But that was not the interpretation. What we have seen since then is that the Bureau of Labor and Industries has interpreted that a building or a project that has any commercial space in it whatsoever, whether it be small or large, and regardless of the amount of commercial space, and regardless of whether that commercial space is true retail types of commercial or office space, or whether it is social services being provided to the residents of the building, that the entire building is covered as a commercial building. We're also seeing now concerns about if a building was once a hotel, it is now, even though its use will be as affordable housing, even though maybe it's not being reconfigured, it was a residential hotel and now is affordable housing, we're seeing interpretations that it would be prevailed. These are also very difficult for our industry. 2430 is an attempt, and I would say probably a labored attempt, to provide this clarity that we need. In Clackamas County, we just had the release of the 2009 homeless count. And in Clackamas County, every night there are 3,641 people who are homeless. 70% of those people are in families with children. Now, my agency serves 2,500 people a night, but in Clackamas County alone, there are that many homeless people who need affordable housing. It's very important for the affordable housing industry that this, that 2530 provide clarity that we need, that it establish basic principles of when prevailing wage should apply and when it should not, and when it should be commercial rates and when it should not. I really urge you to support 2530. This is going to help us meet the needs of our communities by providing affordable housing and providing fair wages for jobs in our communities at a time that we so desperately need them. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'd answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Docho.
Good afternoon. My name is Philip Doko. I work at the Housing Development Center in Portland, Oregon. We are a nonprofit development consultant to nonprofit developers and owners of affordable housing, mostly in the Portland metro area, but also around the state. I'm not an expert in the history of this issue. I've only been working in Portland for a couple of years now. Prior to that, I worked in California. In California, there were clear expectations about what kind of projects would be prevailed. Project managers knew whether or not their project was likely to be prevailed before they started, when they began the planning process. When I came to work at the Housing Development Center, I assumed project management of a project called the Rose Quarter Housing, and I've worked on that for the past 2 years. When I took over, I was assured that the recent legislation that was passed in 2007 clearly applied to the project that I would be working on. In fact, my project was the type of project that the 2007 legislation was meant to address. We received a financing award from the state of Oregon in late 2007 and proceeded to seek a determination from BOLI after we did that, which we received, I think, in February of 2008. Our expectation, as I said, was that the project would not be prevailed, but that was not the case. We received a determination that the project would be prevailed. And what ensued was about a year, I think, of uncertainty as we attempted, first of all, to deal with the potential increase in cost to the project that we would have to somehow fund to make the project go forward, but also a lot of uncertainty as we began a discussion with BOLI over a potential appeal of their determination and the process to get through that. We eventually went through mediation and a hearing with BOLI in November of 2008. And early in this year, 2009, we received a judgment in that, and the project was eventually prevailed. I bring this up primarily because one of the things, a project that we work on is in the planning process for a good 2 to 3 years. And It was mentioned earlier that some of our projects have 10 financing sources. Mine actually had 20 financing sources. And part of what I had to go through in the last few months of getting this project to close and under construction was a mad scramble to make sure that I had all of the financing I needed to build the project. Now, I'm not going to say that the prevailing wage determination was the only reason for that mad scramble. We were actually fairly lucky. We chose a contractor to build the project who was already signatory to a number of union contracts, and our premium for Boley on that project was actually only about 5%. And, of course, this happened in the backdrop of a financial crisis that was also wreaking havoc on the development industry. But I urge you to support this legislation because I think it will give us clear rules consistently applied from the beginning of the process so that a project manager can know up front whether or not, with some degree of certainty, that their project will be prevailed and how they will be able to apply that to the project. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel? Seeing none, thank you both for coming here today. I will next bring up Mr. Myers, Willie Myers, Joe Esmond, and Brian Craig. And after this, there will be two more panels. Please start at your leisure.
Go ahead, Willie. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is William Myers. I'm a business representative with the Sheet Metal Workers, Local 16. I'm here at the direction of my business manager, Len Phillips. We strongly oppose House Bill 2430's exemption to prevailing wage. Our members install architectural metal on the outside of buildings, as well as the heating and ventilation and air conditioning on the inside. All of this work continues from floor to floor, with no difference between the worker that installs from first floor to the fourth floor. Not only would this exemption make it difficult for the contractors to decide what they're going to pay and when they're going to pay their employees, it's also unfair to the workers that are performing the work. There was a lesson to be learned by the New Orleans experience with Katrina. Then President George Bush exempted the rebuilding of a devastated New Orleans from prevailing wage requirements. Even he realized that exempting projects in a down or damaged economy was not a good idea, and he reversed his decision and then re-implemented the prevailing wage rate requirements.
Go ahead, Brian. I'm going to be very short.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg. Today I'm here representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association. We do the HVAC work from the contracting standpoint. I'd like to start by noting that there's been a few comments about prevailing wage not being cost effective or being too expensive. Actually, the predominance of studies that have been done on this show that on average prevailing wage projects actually are not more expensive. They actually break even or can actually be less under many circumstances. To that effect, I have provided to you a little bit of information about those studies. I thought about bringing you the studies today, but I really didn't feel you would really need a doorstop this big in your offices. But the key thing I think Representative Dembro brought up for us from a subcontractor standpoint is that this is going to be an administrative mess for it. The difficulties in keeping track of the work when we have systems that start at the ground level and then go on up through the buildings and trying to figure out, okay, which components and parts of that are really part of the bottom, and even though they might be on the top, this is going to make this very difficult to bid. And what you're going to have a problem arise, one of the things you want to have in bids is apples to apples, so that those who are hiring the services know that what they're getting in the way of materials and equipment and the project being done correctly. This is going to result in a lot of apples to oranges bids where people are piecing it together in different ways, and that may or may not then end up being correctly done. And enforcement will be very challenging also for Boley, in that
we've already seen their budgets being reduced, and this is going to be a very complex type of situation when you're making all these determinations. So this doesn't make the process any easier for our contractors. In fact, it's going to make it much more challenging. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Esmond.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Esmond. I'm a member of the IBW Local 48 in Portland, Oregon. I will be speaking for Local 48 and for the State Association, about 10,000 IBW members. I'll be very quick. It ain't broken. It doesn't need to be fixed. And we keep hearing about referring to the former head of Boley, Mr. Gardner. Mr. Gardner will be here next week in Oregon. He would be happy to come down and talk to anyone or in front of the committee and get some clarification, because he was for sure was there all the time when the bill was passed in 07. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for the panel? Seeing none, thank you for coming forward. Mr. John Jackley and Mr. David Barenberg.
This is
one more after this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm David Barenberg, representing the City of Portland, the Portland Development Commission, and with me is John Jackley from the PDC. We understand the hour is late and that there may not be...
scheduled to be here till 8 o'clock tonight, so it's not...
Oh, well, then I will not crack the joke I was going to, Mr. Chair.
You can meet in your office.
If I may, I'd like to begin with Mr. Jackley, and I'll make a very brief remark at the end.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Jackley. I'm the Communications and Business Equity Director at the Portland Development Commission. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. I'd like to start by saying that PDC is a strong supporter of prevailing wage. Several years ago, with a new board of commissioners, a new executive director, we made a conscious decision to put many of the old practices behind us and to embrace the benefits of prevailing wage in a very strategic way. Our board, working very closely with organized labor, the City Council, the City of Portland, we crafted what became the Portland Development Commission's prevailing wage policy, which in turn became the basis for the new state statute. I have to say I was a little surprised by some of the previous testimony, because when essentially this same package came before the PDC Board of Commissioners, the operating engineers and some of the other unions supported this package. We have extended prevailing wage beyond actually the arm of either the old or the new law, so that now on our demolition and abatement activities, because of our board policy, we prevail anything $50,000 and below and not the $750,000 in the statute. Prevailing wage determinations don't materially affect the financial viability of our large projects. When you're looking at a 40-story tower or a significant development, say upcoming like the post office development in downtown Portland or Centennial Mills, prevailing wage typically doesn't materially affect the project. But when you get to affordable housing, which we finance through either the Housing Authority, the CDCs, other providers, these have multiple revenue sources. They're very difficult to put together, and any change in the financing can have a negative effect. These wage determinations that are inconsistent with the statewide consensus that came out of the Boley statewide task force, the work group last session, and in fact the bill, we believe are hurting not just our but everybody's ability in Portland to provide affordable housing for low-income populations at a time when the recession is increasing this population and increasing the financial strain on the affordable housing community's ability to provide this housing. Mixed use is, as you've heard, is becoming more and more significant because public agencies now invest more and more for sustainable land use and transportation regions along transit lines, whether it's the interstate light rail, whether it's streetcar, even bus lines. The transit-oriented development policies require that when housing goes near transit, which has a very good environmental benefit, that they have some kind of mixed use attached to it. And these projects are kind of at the heart of the debate because many of those projects that we do don't exceed the 20% threshold that we've envisioned. I'd also like to say that affordable housing brings another important part of social equity, and that's minority and women contracting. Affordable housing projects, especially mixed use, have the highest diversity in the construction workforce and with minority and women contracting. PDC, this last fiscal year, we achieved almost 40% minority and women contracting, not ESBs, but 40% minority and women contracting. Our diversity in our contracted workforce exceeds 25%. And these kinds of projects are our threshold because the actual nature of the work is more accessible for small startups, minority women, and other small contracting. I'm currently the board chair of the Metropolitan Contracting Improvement Partnership, which is the citywide organization in Portland that builds minority contracting capacity, and I can tell you that almost all of our members support this bill as well. I don't think the debate that's in front of you is necessarily as complicated as all the details that you've heard. We do and build mixed-use projects all the time. We do split determinations all the time. I have prevailing wage specialists on my staff that do this every day, and I don't believe it's anywhere near as burdensome as what you've heard. And I think the most important thing is not to lose sight of who we're trying to help in all of this, and that's the lowest income, people with no incomes and no other place to live. And I think in this time of unprecedented economic peril, it's an opportunity for you all to help us help those who need it. And I'll end there and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, Mr. Barenberg.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Devlin. Again, Dave Barenberg for the City of Portland and Portland Development Commission. We've heard a lot of complex testimony today, and I just wanted to reduce it to sort of the common elements that we see here or the basic elements that we see here. What we have with this mixed-use housing developments under affordable housing under four stories is in 2430, we think, is a very common sense solution. What the bill says is that for the first floor, it's commercial, that it should be prevailed as commercial. And then for the upper up to three floors, which will be affordable housing, that it's treated as other affordable housing is, as legislation passed in the previous session has dictated. So what's commercial is prevailed, and as commercial, what's affordable is treated as affordable. It seems like a common sense solution to the city, and we hope that the committee would consider moving that solution forward to the benefit of our needy citizens and to encourage the development of affordable housing. And lastly, that the City of Portland does require first floor commercial, as Mr. Jackley has said, for safety, to meet transit goals, so that developers in areas of the city who are trying to develop affordable housing have no choice. So the combination of common sense and public necessity, we hope that you will move this forward. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Barenberg or Mr. Jackley? Seeing none, thank you both for coming.
Thank you. And
good to see you again, John. Okay, I will call up the final two people, Mike Sullivan and Randy Tucker. And even though they are on different positions on the bill,
we're friends. Personally, but maybe not politically. Yeah, go ahead. Thank you, Chair Devlin and committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers in Oregon. And I'm here to testify opposed to, House Bill 2430A. Along with that, my testimony will be verbal, but I have two handouts from the Polk, Marin, and Yamhill County Labor Council in opposition, and Steelworkers Local 8378. All three of us are opposed. All three organizations are opposed to this House bill. Like I said, particularly for us in AWPPW locals and steelworker manufacturing-based companies, it's what we call a two-tier system. And when you pay two workers, two different pays, it becomes a real morale issue. I know I worked as a tradesman in a three-man department, and two of us got more than the third man. It made life very difficult for a long time until we got to resolve the contract languages. So it goes really back to the Equal Pay for Equal Work Act of 1963. No one should be paid less for doing the same work. Our fear is that what is happening or could happen by the passage of this bill will affect our industry. In closing, on a personal note, my mother worked through a two-tier system all her life and raised five children, and it wasn't any fun for her nor five of us. And I would think that if my mother was alive today and a tradesperson in a building, whatever floor, she'd get the same pay as any other worker. Thank you. I would answer any questions that you might have.
Mr. Tucker, and then we'll go to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. Much of what I would want to say has been said more eloquently by previous speakers. I just want to make a couple of quick points in support, I should say, of House Bill 2430. And I want to speak basically at a high level, generally, to the importance of facilitating mixed-use development. From the last panel, you heard some of what I want to say, but let me just briefly say. As you know, Metro is responsible for land use and transportation planning in the Portland region, and one of the key urban development strategies that Metro adopted in collaboration with the rest of the region is the 2040 growth concept. That involves the development of nearly 40 regional and town centers throughout the region. These are areas of higher density that combine housing, employment, retail, and cultural and recreational activities in a walkable environment that is well served by transit. The development of these centers is a key strategy for accommodating the million more people, I should say, that we expect to live in the Portland region within the next three decades, while still using land as efficiently as we can. There are many benefits to developing in centers that range from efficient land use, protection of the farmland on the edges of the region, better air quality, greater transportation choices, and more vibrant communities in general. And if this strategy fails, of course, the region defaults to a sprawling development pattern that no one in the region really wants and that Oregon's land use program was designed in part to prevent. So just briefly, the mixed-use centers are critical for a couple of reasons. First of all, the mixed-use aspect is key to their success. Not only does it make these areas more vibrant and attractive, but it also enables people to conduct their daily business while driving less. The mixed income aspect, the affordable housing aspect, is also important. We have another effort as well to try to raise some money to support affordable housing in centers, because the people that live in affordable housing are the very people that have probably the greatest need of transit and should not be forced to live farthest away from it. And these mixed-use centers are often they're generally associated with transit. So just for those reasons, I'd like to just get on the record our support of the bill that to facilitate mixed-use development.
Mr. Tucker, Mr. Sullivan, any questions from the committee? Sorry you had to wait so long, but thank you for coming here today. This is a public hearing today. A decision will be made later about whether or not the bill goes to work session. Not later today, but later in this session. Well, so thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes. I noticed in the bill file there are some amendments that are discussed. When did you intend, or did you intend to go over those amendments today, or would you do that in another?
I think. Yes, if
Mr.
you would
Chair,
review
I can go
those
into a little detail. Yes, I can.
If you can do it in a
very briefly, yes. What I will do, Mr. Chair, committee members, I'll just focus on the differences in the exemption of prevailing wage rate.
Right.
So the two that are in play, that my understanding from talking to stakeholders, are the -A2 and the -A4. The -A2 would exempt portions of project, and these are all dealing with four-story buildings,
right.
All the same provisions. Portions of project above the podium and do not consist of commercial space. The portion of the project consisting commercial space in which the commercial use is less than 20% of the entire project square footage, the entire project, if the project does not include the podium and the space for commercial use is less than 20%, and also site work, which is defined in the measure. The -A4 only has the exemptions dealing with the projects above the podium not consisting of commercial space and site work.
Okay.
Other than that, the amendments are identical.
So that public hearing is closed. This committee will be meeting again Monday. An agenda will be posted later today. The agenda is pretty full on Monday. It is perhaps not quite as contentious as the agenda today. The committee can expect that we will probably be meeting at 3 p.m. every weekday next week, and probably on into the following week. So with that, we are adjourned. Why don't you get Senator Perry away?